Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, I am talking to Dr. Letitia Menel and Dr. Andrew Fenton, both philosophy professors at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Their specialties include bioethics, epistemology, and animal ethics. Andrew, Letitia, such a pleasure to be able to speak with you today on the subject of the ethics of zoos, and more generally, humans' relationships with other species. I want to begin by asking you if you could speak a little bit about the differences between zoos and sanctuaries. How would you define a zoo?
It's a good question. I mean, a zoo now, and so this would be post-18th century, a zoo now tends to be short for zoological societies. So these tend to be societies that have been formed, sometimes with a history with local scientists involved, that started to collect what they would, you know, scare quotes, exotic animals that were unfamiliar in the local region, largely actually in the very, very beginning of zoos as we understand them in the modern period to study them. These weren't open to the public. It only gradually became open to the public in the 19th century, really. So you're talking about the Victorian era for the kinds of zoos where people go and see these animals, but they tend to still use the term collections to reflect this. So animals that are populating zoos are known as collections, and that goes back to this period of bringing together exotic animals to study and observe.
So I would just take a kind of different tack rather than the historical one. I tend to think about the difference as a question of who is it for? Is it for humans or is it for the animals themselves? So that zoos are tend to be fundamentally for humans, whether they're scientific, right? So for the sake of scientific research, or whether they have a kind of a colonial meaning, which early zoos did, where you sort of show the glory of empire by having animals come back from the furthest reaches of where your folks have been, or whether it's for entertainment. It's fundamentally different than a sanctuary, which is for the animals themselves who are there. Now, I think it's complicated because as animal ethics in our society is changing, you have a lot of people who had zoos and called them zoos or various other terms that kind of indicate their entertainment value, who are now calling themselves sanctuaries.
So is this difference determined by whether or not a facility is governmentally run or privately owned, or is it not as clear-cut as that?
I don't think it's anywhere near as clear-cut as that. We would need legislation that did that job. I mean, I think organizations like the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquaria are trying to have a certain level of standard for zoos and create, you know, just a reliable standard, but that's as close as you get to any kind of legal difference. And of course, they don't really touch on sanctuaries.
And just to jump in, so the reason why you'll find roadside, they're really menageries of collections of animals. So they go back to something almost pre-modern zoo-like. But the reason why a number of them now use terms like sanctuaries is optics. So within the discussion of the ethics of zoos, you know, one of the best high threshold standards for animals in captivity is for zoos to become sanctuaries. So that would mean it would be possible to be both a zoo and a sanctuary, but it would mean, as Letitia has indicated, it would mean that the emphasis has to be the best interests of the animals in captivity. It has to mean that their basic needs are met, which means that there needs to be greater care taken when it comes to the stressor effects of audience viewing. So it would mean that zoos, if they were to become sanctuaries, would have to re-envision how they present themselves to the public on whom they depend for funds, because they're largely funded through folks coming through, because it should allow for the animals to disappear and be out of sight should they find human presence stressors. So if as zoos, because zoos are actually in critical discussions about this, they're very much in a conservation mission mode now. So lots of, like the CASA, the Canadian Accredited Zoos and Aquariums, are trying to push this commitment to conservation. But there has been chatter about, no, they need to go even further. They need to actually take seriously a sanctuary mandate. but it will mean re-envisioning the space for visitors. It means that, as Letitia's indicated, this means the interests of the animals that are in captive holdings, their interests take priority.
So how would a person, just an average person who is thinking of exposing their children to animals, how would that person figure out if the facility that they want to go visit is ethical?
So I think this is where probably your best chance is to go onto the facility's website and see which groups it's a member of, right? So, you know, I think an accredited zoo or aquarium is likely to be better than a non-accredited zoo or aquarium. I mean, if you go to website and there's no mention of any kind of accreditation, I would really definitely avoid that. Zoos and aquaria are very fraught, but I mean, something like the North American Primate Sanctuary Alliance, NAPSA, that's going to be an organization, membership in that organization is going to give you a clear indication about, you know, that it really is an ethically run.
And just to jump in, there's some tools that I'd recommend folks in the public thinking about. One is thinking of academics and scientists as a resource. So the internet has its many minuses because there's a lot of junk on there. But it is the most important achievement we've made in information sharing as a global community. So it's the best world library we've ever created, albeit with a whole bunch of junk interspersed. And so there is a lot of resources online for folks to get to know the animals, looking through natural historical discussions about how they fare in free living populations. And then they need to start just thinking in terms of what they already know ethically about our actions with other animals in coexistence when we're at our best behavior. So think of well-loved companion animals. And I don't mean, you know, ones that are dressed up or weirdly doted on, but their interests are not taken seriously. I mean, animals who we coexist with in our homes, whose preferences really matter to us, so that if they don't want us to, you know, go on holiday, we take that seriously. If they don't want to be kenneled, we take that seriously. That affects our lives. And then start to think of other animals, not so much as little dogs and cats or budgerigars, but then start to plug in the natural history coming in from what we understand of these animals and go, well, how should we coexist with them in these captive settings using the best of our behavior with companion animals in our lives as the metric for how that happens? And then if in a zoo, they see something happen and they go, you know, I wouldn't even think my cat or dog would like that. Those are moments where they go, wait a second. So what are the reasons why they're permitting that to happen? And if they can't think of a good reason that's in the interest of the animals there, that's an ethical moment.
Just getting back, thank you, Andrew. I wanted to ask in more detail about what you were saying, Letitia, about accreditation. So from the work that I do for animal charities, I've learned about the Canadian Association of Zoos and Aquariums and that it's a self-regulating body and that often places that are accredited by CASA, in fact, are some of these roadside zoos. A good example are mobile live animal programs. So some of them are not, you know, in terms of from an animal welfare point of view, ethical at all, yet they're accredited. So could you just maybe in a bit more detail, I know you might not know it off the top of your head, but point me or direct me to a way in which to inform people where they can check out, you know, what kind of accreditation would be, you know, ideal.
Just to take a little step back, I think what's particularly challenging right now is that our norms are changing around our relationships with other animals, which is great. They have to change. We have catastrophic, appalling relationships with many, many animals in our society. And so organizations like CASA are navigating that in that they're, you know, those that aren't members, they have very little impact on. And of course, the laws in Canada are just pretty egregious, right? There are very few laws that really protect animals in captive environments. And so I think they're in this very, very fraught space. My sense is that they know they have some bad actors, but they're hoping to have their membership and their organization make them better actors. that may be the wrong way to go. It's a deeply fraught space. And I think it's very, very difficult for people to know where to go. Certainly, I can think about a local sanctuary that we went to of their open house. And the sanctuary does good work at rehabilitating animals who are injured, wild animals who are or free living animals who have been injured. But that open house, that was just wrong. They should not have had that volume of people around those animals. I understand why they did it, but you know, it's just insensitive to the psychological well-being of those animals to have that volume of humans around. And of course, good for the profile, helps the organization survive in the long run. If they don't survive, they can't do their important work of rehabilitation. So you're in this very difficult space where our norms are changing and we've got a whole bunch of terrible practices which have been normalized for really centuries now, and figuring out how to use the organizations we have, to use the practices and the facilities we have to make things better for animals in captivity, to maybe rule out putting certain animals in captivity. I mean, this is where the new law about cetacean captivity in Canada is so important, saying those animals should not be in captivity, period.
So is one determining factor of how ethical a facility is just merely the species that they're keeping in that facility?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The species they're keeping and under what conditions. So I think, you know, clearly, maybe not clearly, but I would have thought there's a place for organizations to have captive, say, cetaceans for a while if they're rehabilitating injured cetaceans for them to be reintroduced into a free living environment, or if they're giving a slightly better life to animals who have been held in very small aquaria. So I think it's not just particular species of animals who, you know, need to have a certain amount of space or certain environmental conditions in order to thrive. Some of them presumably should not be held in captivity, or arguably should be held in captivity where they can be seen, right? We've got lots and lots of animals who have life ways that are all about not being seen. So to put them on display is fundamentally problematic. If particularly they are aware of that display. I mean, there may be ways to display them that aren't stressful to them, at least at first glance. You know, we have to take into account the species characteristics, the species typical characteristics of animals, and see whether they can fare well under the conditions of captivity.
If a zoo visitor, so if an average person is at a facility, I'm interviewing you today because we had been talking to Rob Laidlaw of Zoo Check about the concept of framing in zoos. And he was saying that really a lot of it is common sense. So if you see something wrong at a facility, speak out. And the way to notice if something is wrong is often just by kind of very basic observation of a particular enclosure. So if a person visits a facility and they have a gut feeling or they notice that an enclosure is, for example, too small or has no natural light or something dramatically wrong with that particular enclosure, what steps do you recommend that they take to help the situation? What is the best route to help?
Well, I would start reaching out to local authorities that are charged with animal care and animal welfare. I'd reach out to their local MLAs, as well as regional MPs. I think in this country, city council as well, I mean, particularly if it's an urban zoo, but we have to see in Canada opportunities here. We're a very small population. That means that we can do quite positive and progressive things if there's enough solidarity in coming together on particular issues. And I think there is in Canada a deep discomfort with displays of animals when they do show a certain insensitivity to stressors that the animals are clearly experiencing, given the way they're behaving, whether they're huddling, whether they have a dampened behavioral expression, whether they're self-mutilating. And so, you know, empowering folks to actually think it's okay. When you see something that you think is questionable, it's okay to reach out to various folks that are positioned in positions of authority, because, you know, they get to make the final decision. If they look again and it turns out you misinterpreted what's going on, then, you know, things will go another way. But if in fact you've stumbled onto something that's actually objectionable and something that is recognizable as objectionable to positions of power, then that can change. And so there's nothing, they don't have to take on a great deal of burden or concern about whether this is bad or too quick to do, because there's various mechanisms in place where there won't be a quick response unless it's glaringly and obviously objectionable.
As a person who's going to a zoo or a sanctuary or wherever you're meeting these animals, how you experience that relationship of you as a free living being and them as someone in captivity, how you experience that matters a lot, and what exactly it teaches you and what you're comfortable with and what you get out of it. And I think that's the kind of really deep question for all of us when we go to see animals on exhibit in whatever context. We're in relation with those beings. What is that relationship and what are we getting out of it?
So when you're talking to zoo professionals about this, also advocates and thinking and the public and thinking about a middle way between zoos now as conservation mission oriented versus sanctuary oriented, the middle way is compassionate conservation. So Mark Beckhoff's been pushing this for at least 10 years, maybe more like 15 years. And compassionate conservation is both committed to conservation principles, but without throwing any individual under the bus. So individuals and their interests count in conservation policy, conservation mandates, and conservation management. And a way to think, the way to help zoos move from, I think, a rather restricted or conservative view of conservation to a more sanctuary-oriented one is through compassionate conservation, where their conservation mandate doesn't throw the individuals under the bus, and their interests and meeting their basic needs to give them a life worth living is a way to bring conservation together with sanctuary through the compassionate conservation frame. And so that framing as well will help in dialogue with zoos to move them from a conservative view of conservation to a much more animal empowering and respectful. I was in a room once with some zoo personnel where the first thing that one of them said is, you know, one of the things that we need to come to terms with as a baseline in discussions of zoos and ethical zoos is captivity is wrong. And so when we take a free living animal or an animal that comes from a free living ancestry, we keep them in a zoo, we have to recognize as a baseline that captivity is wrong. And so they actually have their due for redress. We need to make efforts to change that captivity environment so that it's the best possible thing that we can have for them, given that what we've done as a baseline is wrong. That was in a zoo context where these were zoo professionals talking about that. And you have within that community, people of deep moral character who recognize that the baseline has to be something like that, with the recognition that that puts a great deal of moral burden on folks who would have these animals in captivity. And again, I'd remind the listener that at the best of times, when you're thinking about your companion animals, that's what we do. When we have cats and dogs and, say, parrots or budgerigars in our lives, or fish in our lives, we take it on as a responsibility that we meet their basic needs. And if we can't do that, we shouldn't have them in our life. Note how many animals are in the so-called collection. So if it's an urban zoo, they have limited space. I mean, most of them, you know, they've bought land. It's going to be expensive to continue to expand. Have a look at how many animals they hold, because that'll tell you whether they've extended themselves beyond what is plausibly ethical. Because each of us, when we take an animal into captivity, take it upon ourselves, if we're going to do this ethically, to give them a life worth living where their basic needs are met. And that's just not physical needs, and it's not just health needs. It also includes their social needs. And so these are deeply social animals. There's two things to keep in mind there. One is, how large is the social community in which they live, and how responsive are those in charge to the choice of the animals to socialize with whom they choose. Because most social animals are very, very particular about with whom they interact and with whom they form deep social bonds. And those are important for their well-being. And so if you have a zoo that's crammed in a whole bunch of species, it becomes less and less plausible to think that given their limited resources, that they could give those animals a life worth living where their basic needs are met. So just do a count. If there's a lot of animals in a zoo, I would start to worry about whether what they've done is ethical. If they've actually trimmed them down so that, you know, they have a very select number of animals with large spaces, both visible and not visible, then we're in more reliable territory for this. And so there are ways to do this where it's very simple metric count. Look at how many animals they have. Look at how many we can see from just a look at the internet on natural history sites about how many are really social. And then think deeply about what that means for lots of social animals, just like with social humans. They need to have choice about who they bond with and who they hang out with. And if they don't, something's going wrong.
What are your views on a species being non-native to the region? So for example, obviously there's a big problem with polar bears being shipped to very warm climates and set on display. Is that something else? Or is there an ethical way to display that type of, like a Nordic animal in a warmer climate?
That's a difficult, I mean, you've hit a really hard question. So people like, I think it's Ron who runs the Detroit Zoo, he thinks that you can create Arctic environments. So they have a polar bear enclosure that he's quite proud of. And I'll, you know, leave it to some of the scientists to actually work out with ethicists what actually meets the kind of standard of a life worth living that meets their basic needs. I mean, ideally, I think, and I think if Ron was in the room, if I think he would agree with this point, that ideally what zoos should be doing when they're actually taking on this higher threshold of ethical coexistence, when they do have, like in scare quotes, exotic animals, it's because they're doing something that's normatively deep. Now, the way that zoos will do that now is conservation. So the reason why they will have, you know, scare quotes, exotic animals in their so-called collections is because they're feeding into conservation in one of two ways. Either these are animals that they can continue to breed as breeding stock with the hope of re-release sometime in a to-be-specified future, or they're raising awareness of conservation needs by having these animals in people's faces. I mean, the problem with the first one is most of these animals are not re-releasable, particularly given ecological collapse around the world. So that's disingenuous. And two, you don't need to have an animal in someone's face to have them have an interest. As a number of people have pointed out, most kids go through a stage in their very young life where they love dinosaurs. Like they're all over dinosaurs. They will read everything that they can about dinosaurs. They'll memorize their Latin names. You know, it's no bubble bursting to point out that there are no dinosaurs except birds around. And so it's not the birds that are doing it. It's, you know, the pterodactyls and the Tyrannosaurus Rex in books where they're no longer around. So you don't need them in your face for this. And so...
And there are examples now of wonderful zoos in Japan, for example, that use animatronics and modern technology to create an experience that's much more fulfilling than seeing an animal, for example, circling in a barren tank.
That's right. So my point about the exotic animals would be then when we see them as sanctuaries, first and foremost, they are for rehabilitation of wild animals that can be re-released, but that means their wildness must be kept intact, which goes back to Letitia's point about the intrusion of being watched by humans, because that habituates them in a way that is dangerous to those animals when re-released. You've got to keep them in such a short period of time that you do not adversely affect their learning history, so they still know how to live as free-living animals. And of course, if they're injured and then you have to rehabilitate and you can't release, then the zoo ramps up to this high threshold of sanctuary. And so those are the contexts where I can see, quote unquote, exotic animals in so-called collections. But apart from that, I would have deep, deep concerns about the justifications they have for doing that.
Yeah, and I do think the kind of conceptual issues matter here. Can't call them collections. Stop calling them collections. That has this sort of wrong conceptual meaning. They're not a stack of books. They're not a stack of objects. They're a group of beings. You know, I think it tells you, again, that basic idea of who is it for. If it's for the animals, you're not going to think of them as members of a collection.
just to jump in there, we really need to address the fact that here in Canada, the main piece of legislation we have to protect animals wasn't created for them at all. It's the criminal code. And animals are literally property under the law. So it's so interesting to hear you speak, Leticia, because it's just such, you know, it's so obvious that, you know, this is the biggest part of the problem. And you're
And thingness as well, right? The under law, you're either a person or a thing. And so, you know, we have this unfortunate current situation where animals that, you know, again, at our best, we have three cats. My cats are not things. They're just not. Does that mean that they're persons? Well, under law, that's our only option. So yeah, they're persons. And that means that they actually are entitled to certain protections. They're entitled to the meeting of certain claims that they have to have basic needs met in our homes. And I think that's fundamentally right. But they're not things. And I think at our best, I think most of you people listening to you in this podcast will recognize that at our best, even the wildlife that we have in our cities, so when we have birds come to feeders, they're not things. They're just not. When we see wildlife in a national park, we can, or free living populations, we can see that those individuals, they're not things. But our law has to do better. But we've got to remember, we're in liberal democracies. We're responsible for the laws that we live under. That's what being a liberal, a citizen of a liberal democracy means. We need to change this frame. They're not things. We need laws that say that they're not things, and we need to protect their non-thinghood, which means they can't be property.
Leticia, Andrew, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Yeah. Thanks so much.